Welcome to Write Medicine, where we explore best practices in creating continuing education content for health professionals. I'm Alex Housen, and I'm on a mission to share expert insights and field perspectives on topics like adult learning, content creation techniques, effective formats, and trends in healthcare that influence the type of continuing education content that we create. Write Medicine is the premier podcast for CME CPD professionals like you, wherever you are in the content creation process. Join us.
However, if you are a medical education company or a PCO, which is a professional conference organizer, you have to have a physician-based entity with which to partner in that locality in order to have that education. So that's also a big stumbling block, especially for those of us who come from the medical education community. We're not recognized as a standalone provider, for lack of a better term.
What challenges and opportunities await US-based CME providers looking to expand into Europe? As a CME provider, understanding the accreditation landscape and cultural nuances in Europe is crucial for successfully delivering education to international audiences. In today's episode of Write Medicine, Susan Yarbrough joins me to dissect the complexities of CME in Europe and guide us through the accreditation mosaic. We'll explore key considerations and strategies for navigating European CME, including the need for a strong dose of cultural humility. In episode 107, you'll gain insights into the differences between US and European CME accreditation systems, learn practical advice for partnering with local organizations to deliver relevant education, and discover the importance of adaptability when expanding CME offerings internationally. Tune in to equip yourself with the knowledge and strategies you need to confidently expand your CME programs into Europe and beyond. Well, we have some good conversation topic in front of us today about European CME, European accreditation. But I'd love for you to share with Write Medicine listeners who you are and what you do.
I am Susan Yarbrough, CHCP, and recent fellow to the Alliance. I'm honored this past Alliance meeting with that designation. I have been in continuing education since 2001. I started in a hospital system and graduated or evolved into the medical education space, where I spent a majority of my career working in various positions in an accreditation department, handling all things accreditation, reaccreditation, compliance, all those sorts of things. In May of 2023, I had the opportunity to go out my own and start my own consulting business. So I am working with other organizations on seeking accreditation, either through ACCME or joint accreditation or other accreditation opportunities.
What are some of the key challenges you see in accreditation across those different provider categories?
Domestically, or are we getting into Europe?
Yeah, just talking domestically, first of all. Yeah, I was just curious. I hadn't realized you'd worked in hospital and health systems as well.
That's where I started. And it's, the education's very different. It is the in-service, point of care, bedside, you know, regularly scheduled series, certainly grand rounds, you might have half day or full day educational opportunities, which varied from my experience in the medical education companies, especially where I was, did a lot of the larger medical conferences, you know, either in partnership with a medical society or mimicking a society where it's 2 to 4 days of accredited education, but there's lots of ancillary activities. So there are a lot of compliance issues. If it's trade, you know, the trade show floor, exhibits, to ancillary meetings, somebody wants to have a speakers bureau or advisory board, managing those sorts of things. So vast difference. And then you know, starting out, we didn't have a whole lot of online education. And of course, the pandemic changed all of that and everybody has pivoted and learned, you know, even though the medical education companies I've worked for have, you know, had been evolving into the virtual space, we all flew the plane while we were building it in 2020, 21.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Do you see that same movement into the virtual space in European CME?
No, not really, or at a much, much, much slower pace, in that your EACCME, EACME 3.0, which is the most recent iteration of the regulations that they released in summer of 2023, does have some updated guidelines on how to offer credit in a virtual space. It is expensive, comparatively speaking. It is much more time consuming. I will disclaim, I have not submitted anything recently, much less under 3.0. And I'd love feedback from anybody who has. But my experience in the past was you had to have your content ready to go and fully produced. Mm-hmm. Then it was reviewed and approved. I don't know if they have gotten a little bit more adept or savvy about trusting their providers to do, not to do that. But I know that was a significant time commitment. So you're, you know, especially for virtual education, you want it to be topical, relevant, fresh, and the lag time and resources were rarely conducive for accreditation through EACME for digital. So the EACME system, and that is the probably the most well-known or well-recognized, certainly has the arrangements, you know, reciprocal agreements with the United States and Canada, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And so you're talking about an accreditation system that I'm not familiar with.
And actually that helped me prompt. So in Europe, EACCME, which again is kind of the more familiar for us Americans, there is some alignment between ACCME and EACME. In that, you know, the acronyms are close. They do follow the international, there's the international group of accrediting bodies. There is so alignment on standards and guidelines. However, in the US, ACCME Joint Accreditation approves providers. So you demonstrate as a provider, you know what you're doing, you're meeting all the standards. You know, it is an intensive process, hence my consulting gig. But in Europe, activities are approved on an activity by activity basis. There is a relatively recent movement and implementation by EACCME or EACME to have trusted providers, but that trusted provider status still requires those applications after a long proving grounds to do so. And that does make such a big difference. And the cost is much more significant hard cost if, you know, on an activity by activity basis versus, you know, a providership in the US where you're paying certainly a good chunk of money to become an accredited provider, but it's, you know, the sunk cost.
Yeah, no, that's a good kind of segue into my question, you know, about some of those issues, because I think one of the things that, you know, that I have found surprising over the years is exactly that distinction between in the US, the accreditation goes to the provider. In European context, you know, that accreditation follows activities. And so the burden on providers, you know, in developing, that's just an ongoing process then in terms of getting activities provided and being really future focused.
You know, it really kind of takes the term of planning with the end in mind and really puts a nice little spin on it. The lead time for the application through EACME, again, is much more considerable. It's shorter than it used to be. Used to be quite protracted. Yeah. And the team at EACME does an amazing job. You know, I think they only have 5 or 7 people in their office and they're handling a huge volume of everything that's going on in the European Union. So they get a lot of props for that. However, you know, there is limited bandwidth and it just takes time to go through that process.
And so are there other differences or similarities in the accreditation process or how people are thinking about accreditation and the meaning, the value of accreditation in the European context versus the US? Because, you know, it feels like, you know, I don't work in accreditation, but, you know, as a writer, have to know about it. But it feels like accreditation is, it's a huge deal here. Like it's really one of the hallmarks that sets, you know, non-commercial education apart from education that is being driven by a pharmaceutical supporter.
Well, keep in mind, and, you know, this is something that, you know, is also talk about centering on the concept of remembering what the purpose of accredited education is. And it is ensuring that there is that independent, safe space for the free exchange of scientific or clinical topics without any other restrictions. In the US, it is a big deal because there's the FDA regulations of what can be talked about for unapproved uses, you know, similar requirements in the EU and other jurisdictions. But because of the nuances and differences between those regulations, it has an impact on the European accreditation, you know, if we're still talking about Europe, and on those systems as well, because you have to be much more hyper aware of territoriality, what I call territoriality. Where are you? What's approved in Bulgaria may not be approved in Sweden or in France or in Italy. And depending on when you're holding your education, that may mean a significant difference on what you're going to be able to really cover in your accredited content versus maybe you can't offer any accredited content. The EU process is actually two levels of approval. If you're going through a specialty society, you're going to seek and gain approval from the site. And then it goes to the country itself and gets national approval there. So there's, again, also going back to what we were speaking before, that's another reason for the lag time, because lots of different jurisdictions are looking at this content to, again, make sure it's appropriate and meeting all the guidelines, expectations, regulations that may apply to where you're having your education.
And when you're thinking about the education itself, and thinking about that territoriality, what impact does that have on the content itself?
The biggest impact I will go back to is, you know, understanding where it is in the approval process, especially if I've worked commonly in oncology and gastroenterology, where there tends to be, and over the recent years, a lot more advancements or new indications or new lines of therapy coming out. So the rapid turnover and just keeping up and keeping pace with everything was the big challenge. And again, being so aware of what you can talk about, what you can't talk about was always important. And has been my experience.
You talked a little bit, I think, at the beginning of our conversation about, you know, that reciprocity between, or maybe I'll phrase it a different way, you know, ACCME, you know, has a reciprocal agreement in accrediting, you know, in Europe.
So the AMA has the reciprocal agreement with the EU. So that's okay. The credit, you know, so that's the currency to exchange for those who qualify for it. In this case, physicians can exchange. There is the reciprocal agreement between the EU and the United States that CME credit, the AMA PRA category one credit can convert over to the European credit for medical education units. And I think I've messed that up. It's ECMEC, ECMEC.
I'll make sure to check that and have it in the show
Thank
notes.
Thank you. It is that, but I'm going to mess up what it actually translates to. So the ability to, for learners, depending on where they are, the AMA says and has worked out with the EU that they can trade places. However, it is specific to that territory and where it happens. So it comes down to, if a European physician comes to the United States, they should earn AMA PRA credit that they can go back and turn around and get the ECMEC credit. If an American physician is in the EU, they're going to earn the ECMECs and convert it back to the AMA PRA category one credit. However, one of the things that's going to be interesting is that, say, if I meet all the expectations of my accrediting body and I meet all those standards and regulations and I happen to be an American and I offer AMA PRA Category 1 credit in Europe, what happens that? That A, you know, certainly the accreditation bodies have said, don't do it. You know, there's a reason they have it, and that's why there is this exchange. And if you offer it, even if somebody accepts it, can't they turn around and use it for anything? Will their licensing boards, at whatever level, state, local, on up the chain, local, state, you know, national, what have you, will it even be acceptable, or it's just, you know, not valued?
So there's no kind of uniformity or standardization there in terms of...
There is not.
Right.
AMA has an agreement with Canada. IACME has an agreement with AMA. IACME has an agreement with Canada as well. So, you know, again, I think we're inching there, and I think we will get there. There is the International Academy for CPD Accreditation, which I mentioned before, of which IACME, EACCME, other organizations like the European Board for Accreditation for Continuing Education Health Professions, EBAC, EBAC. There's EBA, EBAH, European Board for Accreditation and Hematology. There is the ESMO, European Society for Medical Oncologists, who have their own credit system. They do MORA, Medical Oncologist Recertification Approval. So there's lots going on. So it's great to see the rising prominence of the International Academy, who is working to align these CPD accreditations and get the standards and guidelines more uniform. For example, you know, evidence-based medicine, separating promotion from education. You know, we know that there are some standard principles that you will see regardless of whatever system you're going to end up in.
That separation of promotional from non-promotional education, the separation of, I guess the whole kind of category of independence, it's not quite the same in Europe as it is in the U.S.
That's correct.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's moving closer to what I've, you know, certainly where I've started and experienced in the U.S. You know, I did my first European activity, I want to say in 2006. So it was a good while ago. And back in the day, it was, of course, thinking pre-2008 and the change standards of integrity and standards of commercial support back then.
Mm-hmm.
Europe was a little bit more loosey-goosey, was a little bit more tolerant.
In so many ways.
Yeah. And tolerant of companies participating in education. And I'll try and be diplomatic and kind of leave it like that. There seemed to be a lot more latitude. Again, you know, as IACME grew, their enforcement has grown, awareness, you know, and all the other factors that have come into play, certainly what happened in the, you know, things that happened in the U.S. make a difference. So one of the big things about 3.0 is, and it has caused some upset, is IACME 3.0 says specifically, satellite symposia cannot be supported by industry. And that does upend a very long tradition, legacy of how education is funded in Europe, you know, especially the large medical societies. They even, when they first published it, even said any promotion cannot leave the exhibit hall. They've kind of walked that back and changed the guidelines. Oh yeah, that's the other fun thing is that EACCME, IACME 3.0, they're still updating and changing things. And it's a little bit of work to stay on top of that. Unfortunately, I missed the session at the Alliance recently. I had a conflicting session I had to participate in. But it requires constant diligence, staying attuned to what's allowed today, what's not allowed today. And certainly the legacy outside of the U.S., the approach to education has been very different. We have a situation in the U.K., and which is going to be really, really fascinating because the Pharmaceutical Board, ABPI,
PPI,
you know, has very strong stance on ensuring that, you know, their industry, and this is their, the Pharmaceutical Association in Britain, has full control over their information. And it seems to now have overlapped into education. The Good CME Practice Group, which is a fantastic collaboration of accredited providers in the European space, wrote a letter to, I think it was published in the Journal for Continuing Medical Education, talking about the real challenge with the ABPI in the UK, because the ABPI says they have sole control over the content, but the whole point of accreditation is that industry doesn't have full control over content. And that's coming to loggerheads. And the short-term result is that a lot of folks just aren't doing anything, you know, and there's no outside education in the UK until this gets all worked out, because companies potentially could be punished for not adhering to their voluntary code because they're adhering to accreditation standards. And I think that's going to be fascinating to watch. I know, so I've been trying to pay attention to that. Our colleague, Eugene Kosniak, has certainly done an amazing job of helping me keep apprised. Thank you, Eugene. And we'll keep watching for that.
Yeah, I think Eugene keeps a lot of us kind of in the loop. And I'll make sure that there's a link in the show notes to that article in JCME.
I have the link. If you've not seen it, I've got the link. So,
yeah, no, I have that link. And I think Celeste.
Yes. Kalenko
was involved in that as well. Yeah. So I just kind of want to walk that back a little bit, because what I'm curious about is, what is it? Why is it that the ABPI is kind of attached to having that control over content in a way that Europe does not necessarily, or European pharmaceutical manufacturers who are based in Europe don't necessarily? What's the driver there?
I'm not as comfortable, because I don't consider myself an authority in this area whatsoever. I've never worked for industry. I've never been, you know, a member of FPIA, European Federation of Independent Pharmaceutical Companies, I believe is the acronym. Certainly not ABPI. You know, as I understand, since these are voluntary associations of industry members, you know, they all opt in, have banded together to establish their own ground rules, you know, strength of numbers, full range of opportunities if it's lobbying, et cetera, et cetera. But they have that voluntary association. And one of the results of that is codes of ethics and other policies that everybody agrees to follow. FPIA certainly does as well. And that, you know, and then even there are some national organizations in the European space, like, that I can't recall off the top of my head. From what I remember when I last read through that situation, there isn't written into that code that they are the sole arbiter and truth sayer of regarding anything that's related to their products. They have to have the final say. I don't see that similar language in EU, the EU. Certainly if the FDA will have something to say about that in the United States. So it's, you know, who's decided that they have the final say is going to be different in the UK versus what we're seeing in the EU and certainly in the US.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of phrasing it too, because of course, education content isn't just about product.
Correct.
And so that thinking about having the final say over product content reflects a very kind of narrow perspective on education, which I guess I kind of find interesting. So let's get a little bit tactical then. If education providers in the US wanted to create education to reach, let's leave the UK out of this. And since Brexit, they've kind of put themselves on the outside of a lot of things.
Right.
But if a US provider wanted to deliver education to address a particular set of needs and practice gaps for audiences in Europe, parts of Europe, how do they go about doing that? What are some of the things they need to be thinking about in terms of accreditation and in terms of collaboration, partnership, the territoriality that you talked about earlier?
First and foremost, lots and lots of lead time. If it's your lead time for doing your due diligence and doing a really thorough, accurate, appropriate gap analysis, which leads to that needs assessment, And the best way you're going to do that is finding a partner who has the footprint in the locality you're aiming to offer your education. First and foremost, for any U.S. provider, you better hold on tight and keep central to this is not the U.S. They're not going to do it like the U.S. The U.S. is not the whiz-bang, best thing on the earth organization. You know, we're not, we may be a superpower in the military, doesn't necessarily mean it translates over to medical education. Having some cultural humility, recognizing it's not just the way we would do it and following the guidelines in the U.S. Do I think they're pretty awesome and it serves the purpose? Well, of course I do. However, I want to ensure first that I really understand what it is and how I can bring value to those, that learner set. How can I, you know, if I'm bringing a fresh new voice, a leading indication, a subject matter expert, something else, but it needs to bring value. But in that humble role of maybe not being in charge per se, and really really first having a grasp of what is that education designed to do? Why in the EU or Africa or Asia, you know, whatever locality you're choosing, being really, really sure you have a role to play to be that provider of education.
I love that you said gap analysis first that leads to the needs assessment, because I think in practice, often we don't necessarily see that happening. And certainly when I talk to writers, I often hear from them that they're being asked to work on a needs assessment and develop the gap analysis.
They're retrofitting it sometimes. Yeah.
Well, sometimes they're retrofitting it and sometimes they haven't actually fitted it at all. They're kind of pushing it all onto the writer. And so it becomes a bit of more of a challenging process.
Well, and I think that further supports the need for having what I think of as the local footprint, you know, that source of information who can give you the environmental scan, a competitive analysis, for lack of a better word, too. You know, what is it like there? Because from an outsider's perspective, U.S. looking into another country's, it may be a nationalized health system. That's a completely different environment than what we have here. Even in Canada, where there's almost, there's a national system and a more robust private system. UK, I think you see that too. But that's very, very different. And it changes, I think, a lot of tactical things you would need to do to be an effective educator. And you really just, again, you got to do your homework, do your due diligence, and know what are you bringing that's different and valuable to the equation that's worth going over to that locality to do that education.
Can you share what some of those tactical changes might look like?
You know, vocabulary. Learn the vocabulary. Mm-hmm. If it's related to accreditation, with EACME 3.0, there used to be a distinction between educational grants and sponsorships. Well, actually now it's all considered together, and that makes a big difference. You know, again, if we're talking about, if you want to do a symposium and you're used to using educational grants, that might have an impact on how you pay for doing that education. Are you eligible? There's now more stringent eligibility. This is the first time I think I brought this up. There's eligibility criteria. If you are coming from an organization that is a physician-based organization, for lack of a better term, say you're a professional society, academic health center, large academic hospital system, what have you, you have, you know, that basis, and EACME says you are in a good, great position to offer education. However, if you are a medical education company or a PCO, which is a professional conference organizer, you have to have a physician-based entity with which to partner in that locality in order to have that education. So that's also a big stumbling block, especially for those of us who come from the medical education community. We're not recognized as a standalone provider, for lack of a better term. We're going to have to find a partner over there in order to offer education.
And that sounds like it might be a huge disincentive.
it's a notable barrier. Notable barrier. I think for entities who have had that history in the EU have got a leg up because they're in a little bit better position. If they don't have the relationship, they at least have somewhere to start to build and initiate, or, you know, have relationships with subject matter experts who can also facilitate or get their institution to jump in and become involved, you know, certainly. So, but if you're brand new, just trying to jump into it, daunting. It would be daunting.
So winners and losers, do you have a kind of visual of who the winners and losers are with the way the current accreditation criteria are established in Europe?
You know, going back to what I just said, you know, those who already have the history certainly have an advantage. Now, are they the winners? I don't know. It's still the barriers that I touched on before, so much lead time to making, you know, gosh, is that education going to stay relevant and topical and appropriate and on time? The notable cost, the fees, and we're talking anywhere from, I think I, when I looked at the fee sheet, it was 200 euro to over 10,000 euro. So it is a graduated, it's a significant dollar amount, you know, converting over for an application. And that's just for the application, just for the application. Consider, again, if you're doing any sort of live activity there, site, travel, honoraria, et cetera, et cetera. It's an investment. And for the larger entities, if it's, again, academic medical centers, large health systems, e.g. Cleveland Clinic, Mayo, you know, they have presence and medical facilities globally now. You know, they do have an advantage. Medical education companies who have a history and success doing continuing education in that space certainly have an advantage. But I'd be reluctant to classify anybody as winner and loser because there's still some real challenges, even for, and I think, you know, I'm not in the right position to speak for my colleagues in Europe, but they're still challenged by the accreditation system. The fact that there's now more than just EACME, EBAC, EBA, ESMO, you know, there's still a lot of choices to choose from. And I don't think it's probably uncommon that ACCME accreditation may still happen over there as well, even though really don't do that. Is it with the ACCME accreditation that may happen outside of the shores? That's a risk. That's a notable, you know, is EACCME again, ACCME, they have this reciprocal agreement and you have to follow their accreditation requirements based on where that location is.
And so crystal ball moment, what do you see happening in the next, you know, sort of 5 or so years in terms of, you know, what's going to shift in terms of the global or international CME that's, I guess there's another question there actually is, what has been the extent of international and global CME and how is that going to change? That's probably a better question.
I think it's going to be a continued slow churn. I think it's not going to stop. I mean, if we think about if there's industry funding that's involved, they have an interest in ensuring it gets out to the widest audience possible. So it makes sense that they would want to extend to every possible clinician they can reach. They're always going to have that incentive to participate in whatever way they're allowed to educate on, you know, disease states, conditions, or upcoming therapies. I think there's going to be the continued alignment among accreditation systems. So it is more consistent. It's kind of surprising that here we are in 2024 that there isn't more immediate reciprocity. Heck, I can call on my cell phone overseas without any problem, but gosh, getting credit, that there is this kind of geofencing issues, if it's political issues or financial issues to other factors that make a difference between where you have your education changes the kind of credit you have. But again, alignment across international borders, I think, will happen. But again, I think at a very slow pace. EACME they've really become much more open. They're much more involved with communicating with providers, communicating with their learners. have had fortunate opportunity to have a couple conversations with Dr. Grenho, Natalie Paulus at the ACME in different venues. And it's been fantastic that they're, you know, they're looking to continue that alignment. They've always had pretty decent relationships with other organizations, but they've really become much more open about it than in past years. Mm-hmm. Hopefully they'll get to the stage where they can handle accredited providers. You know, they have a compliance system, checks and balances to allow for a get more nimbleness for educators and educational providers.
Anything I haven't asked you about that you want to share with listeners of Right Medicine before we wrap up?
So, you know, practical advice that I would offer is, you know, first of all, answer the question, does it make sense for you to expand your audience from where you are? And I think that's true for any educational provider. You're going to have to choose the right accrediting entity, right accrediting body that's going to make sense. Doing the homework and doing the homework above and beyond. It's not going to be your regular, oh, I'm just another project. It's going to require additional resources, additional time. But that embracing of a local partner and representative, A, they're part of the team. If you're doing interprofessional education, you want all the team members there. But having that local footprint to really give you the insights and where you can bring value to your education. Certainly a strong dose of cultural humility. You know, the U.S. has a great system, but it's not the only system. And just because it's not done the American way does not mean it's the wrong way. Put it aside. You really need to make sure you're really focused in on what's appropriate for your learners there. And the last thing is start 6 months earlier than you think you should.
That long lead time.
Go ahead and if it's shorter, all the better. But I would say allow yourself a lot of time, especially if you're brand new to it.
Susan Yarbrough, accreditation expert, fellow of the Alliance for Continuing Education in the Health Professions. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and insights with listeners of Right Medicine.
Again, it's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode with Susan. Here are my takeaways. While European CME accreditation differs significantly from the US, with a focus on approving activities rather than providers, the accreditation landscape in Europe is evolving with a slow but steady movement towards alignment and reciprocity. And reciprocal agreements allow for the exchange of CME credits, but there are still disparities in accepting and using CPD credits across jurisdictions. As a US-based CME provider, if you want to expand your offerings to Europe and beyond, as a first step, research the accreditation requirements and cultural nuances of your target European countries or regions. As a US-based provider, you'll need to understand local guidelines, perform a gap analysis and needs assessment, and have a local footprint to effectively deliver education that is appropriately accredited and tailored to the European audience. We're back on Monday with Monday Mentor. On April the 17th, I'm joined by Virginia Cicciati to explore strategies for creating inclusive CME clinical or patient-facing content. In the meantime, don't miss out on other Right Medicine episodes. Subscribe to the podcast on your favorite listening platform and sign up for Right Medicine Insider for CME and podcast updates. Until next time, stay curious and keep learning.